Welcome to the Unresolved Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Whelan, and this is part two of the Beaumont Children story. On January 26th, 1966, the three Beaumont children, 9-year-old Jane, 7-year-old Arna, and 4-year-old Grant, went missing after visiting their local beach. They were seen by a multitude of witnesses in the presence of a strange man who was never identified. In the years that followed, rumors nipped at the heels of the story, but never led to anything productive. It has now been over 7 years, and on August 25th, 1973, a similar incident begins to unfold just miles from where the Beaumont children went missing. On this afternoon, a Saturday, a football match is raging at the Adelaide Oval, a large stadium located 20 minutes inland in northern Adelaide. Amidst the chaos of the match itself, and the 50,000 people sitting around them, two families are sitting next to each other. Both families, season ticket holders, have seen each other regularly for months now, if not years. They are familiar with one another, and one could say that they've even become friends. Among them are two young girls, Joanne Radcliffe, an 11-year-old that attended the weekend matches with her parents, and 4-year-old Kirsty Gordon, barely old enough to understand the game itself, but who went to this match with her grandmother for the first time. While the match was in progress, Joanne announced to her parents that she needed to use the restroom. Her parents gave her leave to visit the restroom, but Kirsty's grandmother asked if she could take the 4-year-old girl along with her. The two returned minutes later, seemingly unharmed, and all was well. The match continued, and the roar of the thousands around the two families drowned out any concerns of strangers. Roughly half an hour after their first bathroom visit, Kirsty told her grandmother that she needed to use the restroom again. Joanne, being a caring young girl, offered to take Kirsty, and the pair walked off towards the direction of the bathroom at approximately 3:45 p.m. Minutes began to pass, with no sign of the girls returning to their families. This worry eventually turned into panic, and while the match was still ongoing, Joanne's parents began to make their way to the restrooms to try and find the two girls. Kirsty's grandmother remained at the seats in case they returned there. Approximately 20 minutes after the two girls departed, Joanne's mother found her way to the secretary's office and asked if they could make an announcement over the PA system. The request was unfortunately denied, and she was given the explanation that any such announcement couldn't be heard over the noise of the crowd itself. Mrs. Radcliffe would later remark that she believed the workers there just did not want the match interrupted. Over the next hour, the Radcliffe parents would try and search every nook and cranny of the Adelaide Oval, looking for their 11-year-old daughter Joanne and 4-year-old Kirsty. Their search was fruitless, but a request for a stadium announcement was granted roughly an hour later after Mr. Radcliffe got in touch with the secretary of the South Australian Cricket Association. At 5:12 p.m., the girls were reported missing to the local police force, who immediately began a search of the area. Their efforts were just as rewarding as the Radcliffe's. The information gathered by the police hours after the disappearance of Joanne Radcliffe and Kirsty Gordon was disconcerting, and frankly, it was quite alarming. Multiple witnesses had seen a man with the two girls, but the context is the alarming part. By and large, the description of the man matched up with that of the one who was seen 7 years beforehand at the Glen Elg Beach along with the Beaumont children. He was tall, gaunt-looking, and their sketches, which you could find online, roughly look similar to one another. Three of the witnesses that saw the girls after their disappearance recount seeing a man carrying the smaller of the pair, much to the older girl's resistance. This led police to believe that this potential abductor had seized an opportunity to grab Kirsty, but Joanne hadn't liked that one bit and followed the man, kicking and screaming at him as much as possible. At one point, the man, carrying Kirsty, had turned to Joanne and told her to take off, but Joanne had continued nipping at his heels and pleaded to let them return to their families. At least 4 sightings were made of the two girls, with one of them as much as 3 kilometers away from the Adelaide Oval, The last sighting took place roughly 90 minutes after their disappearance, which matches up to when the police had just started to look for the pair. Sadly, Joanne Radcliffe and Kirsty Gordon would never be seen alive again. Just like the Beaumont children, the two girls would disappear from the face of the planet, leaving their family with more questions than answers. Years would begin to pass, with no word of the Beaumont case or the Adelaide Oval abduction getting any kind of conclusion. As far as we know, no credible witnesses or valuable evidence would even be discovered during the next decade or so, and things would begin to stagnate into both investigations. Jane, Arna, and Grant Beaumont would now be old enough to become teenagers and adults. If they were still alive and had any memory of their former lives as children, they would have surely returned home or at least made contact with their parents, who were still worried sick about them. Jim and Nancy Beaumont continued to live at their home on Harding Street, for fear that if their children were still alive, they would return to the home that they had once all happily lived in. In fact, Nancy would recall that there was a muddy palm print of Grant left behind on a sliding glass door that she would refuse to wash off for years afterwards. It was one of the final pieces of her son that she had, and she would refuse to let it just get washed away. Jim and Nancy Beaumont would go on to divorce, eventually leaving behind their house on Harding Street and the public eye for good. Likewise, the Radcliffes and the Gordons had to adjust to life without their daughters. As months began to turn into years, the likelihood of their children being returned safely began to turn into little more than just a dream. Both cases would stagnate over the next decade, or at least until 1979, when tragedy began to compound upon tragedy. The heartache of Adelaide wasn't over yet. It was just coming to light. In 1979, the body of a 17-year-old young man would be found in the South Para Reservoir, located in northeast Adelaide. This would begin a dark chapter of Adelaide history, known to many as the Family Murders, a story as dark and mysterious as any, and deserving of its own episode of the podcast. To try and summarize the story of the Family Murders would be to do the victims injustice, but I'll try my best. Starting in 1979, and supposedly ending in 1983, at least five victims, all teenage boys and young men, would be found. All of them would be discovered having suffered terrible torture and mutilation, each of them having been sexually abused to a drastic degree before their deaths. As I said, the Family Murders are without a doubt a story deserving of its own episode. But the murders of these five young men lead many to believe that there was an organized effort to kidnap, torture, mutilate, and kill them. I'll try and refrain from going into too much detail on this episode of the podcast, but let's just say that reading about the crimes committed against these poor young men made me, a true crime fanatic, feel absolutely squeamish and sick to my stomach. But after the bodies began to pile up, and the known victims became known to the public, a case began to grow. When drugs were discovered in the bloodstream of the fifth victim, who was killed and his body discovered in 1983, the case found itself a suspect. A man known only as Bevan Spencer von Einem. To call Bevan Spencer von Einem evil would do the term evil injustice. He was a roughly 40-year-old accountant charged with the kidnapping, torture, sexual assault, and murder of Richard Kelvin, a 15-year-old boy. During his questioning, von Einem's story had changed several times, becoming less likely throughout each incarnation. He had no alibi for the night Kelvin disappeared, claiming he had been sick with the flu at home by himself. But when fibers of his clothing were found on Kelvin's body, along with hairs that would later be confirmed to be his, he claimed that Kelvin had been there on the night of his disappearance, for purely innocuous reasons. Needless to say, von Einem was convicted of the charges piled against him, the evidence overwhelmingly on the prosecutor's side. He was sentenced to life in prison. and given a no-parole period of 24 years, which would later be increased to 36 years, an Australian record at the time. The state had no evidence that von Einem had committed the other four abduction murders that had taken place in the months and years beforehand, but he was away for life and would never confess to the crimes. He still hasn't to this day, despite the overwhelming evidence and belief that he was responsible or involved in the other four murders. The family murders, as they would later begin to be called, would fall off of the radar. The police began to believe that the supposed organization behind the crimes, of which von Einem was just a member of, began to lie low after his conviction, but had been responsible for many more disappearances in the Adelaide area. In the years following his conviction, many have begun to theorize that von Einem himself was responsible for the abduction and disappearance of the three Beaumont children. This was made possible by a witness known to the public only as Mr. B, a former friend of von Einem that had been heavily involved in the gay community of Adelaide. He would claim that von Einem had confessed to the murders of both the Beaumonts and the two girls at the Adelaide Oval years earlier, which led to a split in their friendship at a time where von Einem began to fall in with what would later be called the family. According to Mr. B's testimony, von Einem had claimed to, in his words, connect the three children. To many, this brings about thoughts of the recently made movie The Human Centipede and the disturbing mental image that comes with that. This testimony from Mr. B claimed that one of the children had died during the process, and that all three had been disposed of shortly thereafter. I feel odd telling you about this, because this is all backed up by absolutely no evidence and should only be taken at a surface level. Mr. B, as he has been known by the public, was a drug user with a history of criminal actions on his own part, who may have simply been trying to cop a plea deal by offering up these sensationalist details. So please take this theory with a grain of salt, if at all. The idea that von Einem can be connected to the Beaumont children is tentative at best. The suspect who had been seen with the children the day of the disappearance was aged in his mid-30s, while von Einem would have been only 20 at the time. Photos of him at the time show that von Einem looked older than he was, but he had darkish brown hair, which stood in direct contrast to the blonde hair declared by the witnesses. However, recently a photo has begun circulating the internet which claims that von Einem was a spectator of the police investigators combing the Glen Elg beach the day the children disappeared. This is only a guess, and it's not at all a forensic truth, so maybe look up the photos online and make your own judgment. To this day, Bevan Spencer von Einem is still serving his life sentence, and is unlikely to ever be a free man again. In 2007, the South Australian Premier, Mike Rann, vowed to enforce a new legislation to make sure von Einem would never leave prison alive. He is one of the most hated figures in all of Australia for his connections to the vile family murders, but his illegal activities didn't end with his conviction. In 2009, he pled guilty to creating child pornography by writing fictitious stories in prison, and he has had many similar charges filed against him since his incarceration. He will undoubtedly be in prison until the day he dies, but our story does not end there. In 1998, Crime Stoppers aired a segment about the 1970 murders of two young girls in Townsville, a town along the northeastern coast of Queensland, Australia. The two girls, 5-year-old Susan and 7-year-old Judith McKay, had been waiting at their school bus stop on the morning of Wednesday, August 26th, 1970. 2 days after the girls' disappearance, their bodies were found in a dry creek bed with their school uniforms folded neatly in their school bags next to them. Both sisters had been raped, stabbed, and strangled. For almost 30 years, their murders remained unsolved in northeastern Australia, an entire continent away from the Beaumont and Adelaide Oval disappearances. The family of the McKay sisters was left in anguish for decades, at least until the airing of that Crime Stoppers episode in 1998. After watching that episode, the Crime Stoppers phone line received a phone call tip from someone who claimed to be loosely related to an alleged suspect. The person on the other end of the phone had seen the description of the suspect at the time, and realized that it matched that of her cousin's husband. She had also been a former molestation victim of said man, and was well accustomed to his illegal and illicit activities. Arthur Stanley Brown was now in his mid-80s, and he had been living in Townsville for most of his life. As detectives began to dig into him as a suspect in the Townsville murders, they found not only a closet full of skeletons, but a graveyard. Over the next few months, Australian detectives amassed over 45 charges against Brown, which included molestation, sexual assault, pedophilia, and of course, the murders of the McKay girls. Their case was aided by eyewitnesses and victim testimony given to them by many of Brown's own family members, including his wife's family, which consisted of many women who had been molested or sexually assaulted by Brown when they were younger, some of them having been taken to the same creek bed where the McKay girls had been found. Detectives uncovered the knowledge that Brown, who had been roughly 60 at the time of the McKay murders, had worked as a carpenter at the girls' school. Apparently, in the weeks and months following the murder, he had become personally obsessed with the girls' murder, making many weird choices. The oddest of which was the off-color door from his car, a very identifiable mark, which he removed and then buried in his yard. Yes, you heard me right. He removed a car door and buried it. His explanation for it at the time, he didn't want to be harassed about it by anyone, because his car happened to match the exact model used to abduct the girls by passing eyewitnesses. He would later dig up the car door and take it to a junkyard, essentially. But his behavior at the time was odd in other ways. He went as far as inviting two of his wife's cousins, both of them young women, to the crime scene to just look around. And it wasn't just odd behavior around the time of the murder either. Brown allegedly had dozens of victims, ranging from when he was a younger man to his elderly years. Also, there's a bit of a strange matter concerning his first wife, Hester, who died mysteriously a few years after the murder in 1978. Her death certificate was written by the family doctor, who wrote it without even examining the body, which was then cremated just hours later. Immediately following his wife Hester's death, her younger sister Charlotte moved in with Brown, along with her 5 children. Brown and Charlotte would marry just months later, as if a devastating death hadn't occurred at all. However, legal advice was given, which can basically be surmised as, taking him to court might be traumatic for the victims, so best not to. The entire matter was swept under the rug and became a dark family secret, at least until that 1998 episode of Crime Stoppers. The secrets about Arthur Stanley Brown came to light, and they weren't pretty. In 1999, after the years of his exploits being kept in the shadows, Arthur Stanley Brown was taken to court. He was now in his 80s, having spent the better part of his life escaping from justice, and he seemed poised to do it one last time. Despite the evidence and testimony stacked against him, including that of 2 people who he had supposedly confessed to decades beforehand, Arthur Stanley Brown was able to escape justice via his own mental health. In 2000, the trial had to concede for reasons of circumstantial evidence being unfit for trial, which then led to a delay. But then surprisingly, newspapers began reporting that the trial could not proceed, quote-unquote, for legal reasons which cannot be published. A year later, this would be revealed to be due to Brown's worsening dementia and his struggle with Alzheimer's, which left him unfit to stand trial or even plead the case. One would think that Brown had simply escaped justice, but he might have found justice of another sort. In April of 2002, his wife Charlotte would pass away, and Brown was abandoned and ostracized by his entire family. His funeral was kept under wraps and unpublicized, with only one stepdaughter being given the notice of his passing. Weeks after he had been buried, one of his stepsons would remark, "I can't believe such an insignificant little arsehole had such a profound effect on so many people's lives." If that's not a glowing review of Brown's impact upon the world, I don't know what is. The surviving members of the McKay family have come to terms with the knowledge that Brown committed the rape and murder of Judith and Susan. In fact, immediately after his death, police would close the case file completely, believing him to be the lone suspect. In the years since his death, many have begun to question whether or not Brown was responsible for the disappearances of the Beaumonts and the Adelaide Oval abduction. He did live in Queensland and worked for the Department of Public Works there, an entire continent away from Adelaide. But when investigators went digging for records of his holidays and vacations, they found nothing. Whether or not these records were destroyed during the 1974 Brisbane flood or discarded by Brown himself, who had open access to the government offices because of his position with Public Works, is an open mystery. He did have a history of trying to hide evidence of his misdeeds, courtesy of the buried car door, so anything is possible. One of the witnesses from his trial would confess that Brown had remarked about visiting the Adelaide Festival Center during its construction, which would place him in Adelaide after June of 1973. The abduction of Joanne Radcliffe and Kirsty Gordon took place in August, just a few months later and shortly before the construction project finished. There is also the matter of his physical description, which is one of the weirdest parts of the story. Brown bears a strong resemblance to both of the sketches provided to police after the Beaumont disappearance and the Adelaide Oval abduction. However, while Bevan Spencer von Einem was too young to match the description of the suspect, Arthur Stanley Brown would have been over 50 years old for both abductions, making it very unlikely that he would look like a fit 35-year-old man. Another interesting note is that one of the witnesses during the Adelaide Oval abduction remarked that the man who had grabbed 4-year-old Kirsty Gordon was wearing horn-rimmed glasses, which fell off during his getaway. Arthur Stanley Brown would wear those type of glasses constantly, so much so that during his youth they remained a part of his wardrobe. It's possible that Arthur Stanley Brown was responsible for the disappearance of the Beaumont children, but unfortunately, there would be no way to know for sure. His death in 2002 undoubtedly meant that the rest of the secrets left in his decrepit, failing mind would die with him. In the ensuing years, more possible suspects have continued to be thrown onto the proverbial pile. Known criminals such as James Ryan O'Neill and Derek Ernest Percy have been implicated in the Beaumont case in one way or another, although their connections to the case are normally rather tenuous. In recent years, a deceased man known as Arthur Stanley Hart, who passed away in 1999, has been implicated by members of his own family in the Adelaide Oval abduction, after a secret basement was discovered on property he once owned. Police have admitted that he was a key suspect throughout that investigation, but no links to the Beaumonts have been discovered. In 2013, a book was published titled The Satin Man, which claimed that wealthy Adelaide businessman Harry Phipps was responsible for the Beaumont children's abduction. This was based off of evidence from Phipps' troubled son and testimony from other family members, but when pressed for a statement, police revealed that Phipps was not a serious suspect and they were not investigating him for the Beaumont disappearance. The 50th anniversary of the Beaumont children's disappearance came and went this past January, meaning that each of the children would be approaching their 60s if they were still alive. Their parents, Jim and Nancy, are still alive and are now both approximately 90 years old. Both live in privacy, but no doubt hold out hope that they will be given some kind of answer to their children's fate. A week before the case's 50th anniversary, on January 19th, the police received a tip via a phone call, which has led to a recent renewal in the interest of the case. Just like the Beaumont parents, the police hold out hope that the case can be solved, and the $1 million reward for the case still stands to this day. But police have come to the realization that if a suspect is to be named, it needs to be now. Any possible suspects would now be between 70 and 100 years of age, meaning that any new evidence is likely to come from a deathbed confession or family insiders. If you happen to know anything about any of the cases mentioned in this episode, please contact the Adelaide authorities. For the time being, the fates of Jane, Arna, and Grant Beaumont, along with those of Joanne Radcliffe and Kirsty Gordon, remain unresolved. Wow, that's all I have to say about this one. this episode of the Unresolved Podcast was no easy feat to put together, but I won't bore you with those details. I'll just apologize for the long wait you had getting to it, which was made necessary due to a recent change in my life, which was a pretty huge one. This episode was made possible by the efforts of both Tyson Nordgren, who handles the editing and mixing portions of the podcast, along with creating most of the music heard throughout, and Nick Miller, who did a lot of research into the case, helping point out certain aspects I would have otherwise left out or ignored. Both of them are owed a huge debt of gratitude by me in helping get this episode off of the ground, a feat that seemed impossible to me just weeks ago. Thanks, guys. I also owe a huge thank you to Ailsa Traves, who wrote another awesome song for this podcast. You could find a link to this new song, along with the one she wrote episodes ago, the one you're hearing now, on the podcast website, www.theunresolvedpodcast.com. There, you could also find links to the research I used, transcripts for each episode, and many other things like that. If you want to keep in touch with the podcast, you could do so at Facebook, just search for The Unresolved Podcast, or at Twitter, at Unresolved Pod. I changed it a little, just to make it easier to find for newcomers. If you want to text or leave a voicemail for the podcast, you can do so at 831-200-3550. This is a good way to get a quick response. And I do listen to all of your voicemails. Yes, even the creepy ones. I'm looking at you, Aaron. If you want to make the next episode come out a little quicker, you could definitely head over to the show's PayPal page, paypal.me/theunresolvedpodcast, and leave a donation. I'll also be officially launching the show's Patreon page in the near future, now that I have some free time, so that'll hopefully be a more rewarding option for everyone. However, that's it for episode 10 of the podcast. I don't know what story I'll be trying to tackle in the next episode, but I can guarantee that it'll be coming out quicker than this one. Thankfully, I have a lot of free time on my docket over the next few months, so I hope to really dig into some stories I've been shying away from. It's an exciting time for the podcast, so I hope that you hear from me soon. Until then, stay safe. Goodbye, everyone.